Yeah.
The numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board.
Oh.
11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Boxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Boxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up here on the Head-On Radio Network for Wednesday night or Thursday morning or Thursday afternoon, all depending on where you reside on this beautiful blue marble, such that it still is it Thursday or Friday? I get so confused, living in in two different time zones all the time. Gets to just be, well, just a bit confusing from time to time. But anyway, we're going to get it. There's a really good report out of the UK on greenwashing. Thanks, Bob. It's Friday here in Australia. I know, it's early Thursday. It's Thursday here. Jeez, I'm all over the shop. But anyway, see what happens when I miss a show. But, you know, it all just starts running together. What day is it? What country am I in? I have no idea. I'm going to get into this really great report on greenwashing. Now, greenwashing is that concept of advertising things as being environmental when they're not. And we have a lot of this going on now. It's kind of one of the new common scams that we deal with now, that being green or being environmental, has become something much more mainstream. Companies are using false claims or unverifiable claims and other things to make themselves look green just to sell product, whether or not they actually, you know, can stand up to their claims, but we'll get into that in a bit. But first, let's get into the music for today. The band that I've chosen today is just purely fun. Primus, one of the more unique bands in the last couple of decades. One thing that I've always liked about this band is the fact that the roles that each musician plays have kind of been turned on their head. The guitar is slightly more straight rhythm instrument than the bass guitar is, and the bass guitar takes more of an upfront kind of thing, and Les Claypool has played, you know, various different, very strange bass guitars, where, you know, six-string bass guitars where, you know, the first seven frets of the fingerboard are actually fretted and the rest of it's fretless, and really unusual hammer-on technique. And they're a band that actually kind of defies any kind of categorization. And what I find in, what I found interesting on the Wikipedia page, I did not know this. Les Claypool himself once described the music as psychedelic polka. Primus is the only band with its own ID3V1 genre tag from Winamp. So they have their own category all to themselves. That's how hard it is to nail these guys down. So I've got three tracks from three of the early albums. And the drummer in this, they've had a couple of drummers through the years, but I think on most of this stuff it's Tim Alexander, but I could be wrong. Great in the pocket player. And when the band first started, it was just Les Claypool and a guitar player and a drum machine. Just a real, and I remember years ago Primus coming and playing that Texas bar that I did production for, and it was amazing. And I remember an early interview with Les Claypool when asked who his musical influences were, and he said Rush and Looney Tunes. I kind of think that it really sums it up rather well, because it is kind of psychedelic polka, unusual stuff to say the least. They're definitely their own thing. So I reckon we should start with off an album from, I believe it was 1992, Sailing the Seas of Cheese. This is probably one of the bigger hits that they had, a track called Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, and I think that this kind of brings the concept of the Rush and the Looney Tunes cartoon mix. You know, it's a great example of it. So we'll start there from Sailing the Seas of Cheese. Like I said, this is a band that's kind of into being a little bit tongue-in-cheek, a little bit funny. Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, Primus. Roll it, Bob.
Karen.
Sorry. Bob just asking, where's this band from? I go, California. He goes, kind of a Chili Peppers flavor to the guitar, too. And he says, anybody wearing a sock on their Johnson? No, I don't think so. Not in this situation, Bob. And I remember, as we were playing that track, I remember, this was back in the day when I was really working hard with the at the whole making the band thing work, and how many sound checks I went through where some guy was sitting there trying to play that bass line on a standard bass. It was usually a really pathetic endeavor. never really worked. But my old guitar player from an old band of mine, Truck, it first introduced me to Primus, and I think the first song I ever heard was this next one off of their first studio record called Frizzle Fry. And I mean, you gotta appreciate just the whole concept of consistent parody. Primus released their records on Claypool's Prawn Song Records label, a parody of Led Zeppelin's Swan Song. You know, this is all about having fun and having fun with music, and I think it's great, you know. And I know a lot of people will just be like, that sounds like noise. That sounds just like insane. But it's breaking the molds of what popular music can be. But this next track, I do think that this is the first Primus track that I ever heard. And so this is off off the debut record, full-length studio album. And this is called Too Many Puppies, and I think this is from 1990. And this is just, again, another very kind of eclectic, very odd bit of music. Go ahead and roll it, Bob.
Too many puppies.
Bob and I are having this great little conversation in our little production chat here, you know. And I was saying how it's so rarely done, but I love that sound of chords being played on a bass. It's just got so much punch and so much power. And I made the comment to Bob saying, well, Les Claypool's a bit insane. And he says, a bit? And Everest is a hill. And Lottie, if you thought that was a song to listen to, Stone, this next one is definitely one to listen to, Stone. And for some reason, I could picture someone doing a really great video clip of George Bush singing this next song. Because in the minds of the American people, his name is Mud. And this track is, as far as I remember, at least when I was still in the States, this is probably the biggest single that they had. I believe this is the third album titled Pork Soda. Nothing serious about anything about this band aside from the musical prowess that it takes to create it. And because they had been touring really hard for a couple of years leading up to the production of Pork Soda, this is a much darker record than the stuff that had been previously released. And the video clip for this was quite huge in rotation on MTV. And this is another classic. It's all, you know, it's all along the same vibe. I mean, you're talking about a very unusual bass player, to say the least. And one of the things that I always did like about this band, which kind of went against the production value at the time, you listen to the drums in this. Unlike a lot of things that were being done at the time, you know, Alice in Chains, a lot of the death metal stuff, a lot of the funk metal stuff that was happening at the time, it was always about big, huge, massive drum sounds. And these guys went with the opposite approach. The drums are very tight. The snare drum is very small. But it makes, if it was too big, it would be too boomy and nothing would come through clearly. So, you know, it's definitely done by design. It's got to be a teeny little piccolo snare drum for the most part, just going by the general tonality of it. And it was very much counter to standard production value of the time. And so this is where, you know, and this was after they were going for a few years, this album. And like I said, it's slightly darker. And so without further ado, from Pork Soda, I believe from 93, don't quote me, My Name is Mud. Roll it, Bob. And just picture George Bush thinking.
My name
just insane. Absolutely insane. And you got to appreciate, you know, that track is just such a great example of how they kind of turn the roles on their heads, you know. The drummer's hardly playing. Most of that punchy rhythm is all palm-muted, fretless, slappy bass nonsense. And again, there was another one of those riffs that I heard played painfully badly during sound checks for many, many years. Poor bastards trying to pull something off with an instrument that they don't even have. Because it is a bizarre instrument that man plays. But anyway, and they're still going. The band's reformed recently. There's supposed to be an album coming out this year. Be very curious to hear what that sounds like. There's also other side projects that Claypool did, like Sausage, which I also saw years ago. Similar to Primus, but a bit more guitar heavy. But yeah, some interesting stuff. So if you like something a little odd, Primus is definitely fills that hole. So anyway, that's enough of that for today. Now, Gene sent this to me earlier, and it's been something that's been getting a little bit more coverage recently, and it's the idea of greenwash. And the Celsius article, which links to this study PDF, which there are links to all this on the show post today, thank you, ELO, says here, for a year, Ed Gillespie made his way around the world without setting foot on a plane. Along the way, he blogged about his low-carbon adventures and wrote a regular column for The Observer. But these days, he's back in the offices of Futera, the communications agency he helped found, turning to another kind of writing. Most recently, the UK-based agency that focuses solely on corporate responsibility and sustainability released a report on the state of greenwash, that advertising method that companies use, as Gillespie writes, to out-green their competition. Now, I would definitely recommend downloading the PDF. It's 44-page, beautifully done PDF on greenwashing. Now, I'm just going to flip through here for a minute and get you the actual definition. The full and rather difficult-to-read version of the Oxford English Dictionary defines greenwash as disinformation disseminated by an organization, etc., so as to present an environmentally responsible public image, a public image of environmental responsibility promulgated by or for an organization, etc., but perceived as being unfounded or intentionally misleading. Perhaps more simply put, without words like promulgated, greenwash misleads the public by stressing the environmental credentials of a person, company, or product when these are unfounded or irrelevant. And that's probably the second part of that I happen to notice more often than not is the fact that most of the stuff that looks dodgy is usually stuff that's irrelevant. You know, just making up claims that really don't mean anything. You know, I make toxic cleaner brand X. And I have a plant-derived cleaner in my chemical cleaning product. So I am better than similar company A, B, C, D, E, and F. Well, yeah, you might be marginally better than the other horrible companies. And these are tactics that are used time and time again. Let me just go back here. It's a really, really good, really, really great document here. The two-minute version. Greenwash is with us, and unless we take action, it's likely to be with us to stay. Greenwashing is an environmental claim which is unsubstantiated, a fib, in other words, or irrelevant, a distraction, found in advertising, PR, or on packaging, and made about people, organizations, and products. Greenwash is an old concept wrapped in a very modern incarnation. And greenwash is growing. The Advertising Standards Authority in the UK is upholding more and more complaints against advertising that can't live up to its green bluster. Around the world, regulators are trying to keep up with, and the USA's Federal Trade Commission has brought forward to 2008 its plan to review their environmental marketing guidelines. France has just announced new guidelines, and the UK is reviewing the advertising green claims guidance. But is this enough? Why all the fuss? Greenwash isn't simply annoying, it's dangerous. In a market economy, and the consumer is king, and consumers have started sending strong environmental signals through their purchasing. This growing green pound is a powerful force compelling the economy to clean up its environmental act. But consumers often rely on advertising and other corporate messaging to inform their purchasing choices. Pardon me. And greenwash is undermining confidence in that advertising. That confidence is now at an all-time low, with only 10% of consumers trusting green information from businesses and government. Without confidence in the claims, consumers are reluctant to exercise the power of their green purchasing, as they no longer know who or what to believe. You know, this is really similar to the way that we deal with drugs in the United States. You know, all the misinformation that goes down about marijuana. The run-on effect that I believe that it has by being dishonest about this one aspect of the so-called war on drugs. When young people find out, as they start to read and research for themselves, that all the fear-mongering over this one drug is untrue, why will those kids then trust you about all the other things you say about all the other drugs that are out there? So if you lie to them about pot, why are they going to trust that same adult when they tell them that heroin's dangerous? So I think it kind of plays in a similar thing here, that if people, you know, become suspect of these claims, they're not going to believe any of them, the true ones or the false ones. Let's see. That confidence is now at an all-time low, with only 10% of consumers trusting green information from businesses and government. Without confidence in the claims, consumers are reluctant to exercise the power of their green purchasing, as they no longer know who or what to believe. This puts the whole market for the green pound in danger and might damage the virtuous circle of companies promoting their green products. Consumers choosing them over non-green products, thereby encouraging businesses towards greater greenness. Greenwash is the spanner in the works that could sabotage the whole environmental movement within business. The guide reveals the industries most actively greenwashing and those environmental claims most likely to be greenwash. Not enough is being done to prevent this accelerated negative feedback loop. None of the UK's biggest advertising agencies claim to have training or guidelines for their staff on what is a justified green claim, and none of the main publications in the UK who sell advertising space have their own standard. Being asked about Clorox and Greenworks, I don't know anything about those products. I'll have to have a look, but I'd always be wary of an outfit that, you know, their main product was bleach. How much of it is exactly this greenwashing? You know, we have some bleach based cleaner and we've added some tea tree oil to it. I mean, I don't know enough to make a judgment, but I gotta say, my brain can automatically go to things that I might not necessarily believe. They say here, it's all not bad news. Most greenwash is due to ignorance and or sloppiness rather than malicious intent, and businesses and advertising agencies can take simple steps to prevent greenwash slipping through. As a consumer, you too can spot the worst greenwash symptoms, and this guide lists the simple tests of greenwash versus good claims. Tear off and keep our simple greenwash guide postcard for when you're shopping. At a time of impending economic challenges, it's more vital than ever that green messages have credibility. The next few years will demonstrate together companies, agencies, and consumers can spin this virtuous cycle, or if if runaway greenwash will bring the new green revolution crashing down. Now, they get into the top 10 signs of greenwash, and they're actually pretty simple, but it's the simple things that can be the most devious. Number one, fluffy language. Words or terms with no clear meaning, and the example that they give is eco-friendly. So with nothing to back it up, fluffy, you know, happy language isn't good. The second one is green products versus dirty company, such as an efficient light bulbs made in a factory which pollutes rivers. And so this is one of the ones where it gets more difficult. You know, you may have a legitimately green single product, but if the company that makes that one green single product does damage while doing their business, well, then it's not a green purchase. You know, this is what makes it really difficult. You kind of have to track back through the ownership of virtually everything you buy. Number three, they say suggestive pictures. Green images that indicate unjustified green impact. The example given is flowers blooming from exhaust pipes. And we've seen this, haven't we? We've seen car advertisements, you know, where they do, you know, tricky CGI stuff, you know, where, you know, it's a black and white shot until the car passes by, and then after the car's passed by, out of the exhaust comes all the color in the picture, and, you know, aren't we environmentally nice because we made a green-looking ad? They move on, number four, irrelevant claims, emphasizing one tiny green attribute when everything else is ungreen. This is probably one of the most common that I've noticed in consumer products, is making claims on one single thing when it's only cover, you know? And tied into that is their number five, best in class, declaring you are slightly greener than the rest, even if the rest are pretty terrible. You know, this is like, you know, Shell and Exxon talking about how they're making environmentally friendly fuels, you know? It's all marketing. Number six, just not credible. Eco-friendly cigarettes, anyone? Greening a dangerous product doesn't make it safe. How very true. Number seven, gobbledygook. Jargon and information that only a scientist could check or understand. That is, I've seen that kind of thing attempted. And you do see these kind of claims, you know. You know, I was saying to Bob the other day, Bob's just telling me, coal, America's green energy alternative. No, really, they advertise it that way. Perfect example. Perfect example. The example I was just going to use is at the green grocer that we go to, they've recently been carrying this apple juice that says sustainably grown, but it doesn't say anything else. So I still want to do the research to find out what is it that they've done that has made their orchard sustainable. I'm not doubting them. I'm not doubting them yet, but I'd like to know more. The next one they have is imaginary friends. Now, this is the one that you see a lot. I've seen huge amounts of this. A label that looks like a third-party endorsement, except that it's made up. And seen this here in Australia with some of the recycled toilet papers, where, you know, they'll have some puffy looking tree icon thing saying, you know, sustainable farming, and put something that looks like some sort of logo to legitimize it, when actually the logo is completely meaningless. You know, I could just go into Photoshop, make a little icon with a tree, make it green, make it look all nice and soft and cute, and stick it on something and say, this is an environmental product. Nothing to back it up. Which goes to number nine, no proof. It could be right, but where's the evidence? So this is just like I'm saying about this apple juice, which I was really happy to find an actual juice in Australia, aside from the boutique ones, that isn't made from reconstituted juice. So I was happy to find that, because it just seems like, you know, for some reason they have to concentrate all this stuff before they can put water back in it and stick it in a bottle. I don't quite understand that, but hey, that's the... if that's... and then number 10, outright lying. Totally fabricated claims or data. There's plenty of that out there. And it does make it difficult to, you know what to believe and what not to believe, you know? And not everyone follows the subject the way that I do or other people that listen to this program do. And it's those that aren't really up on things that are going to get suckered by this. People that have just gotten... What? Nanette says she's... Great example. Nanette just says she saw a billboard about coal today. Coal. Carbon neutral energy. Carbon neutral? Carbon neutral? See, that's just outright lying. That's outright lying. I mean, I do not see how they're able to even say that. Which I think is part of the point of this study. Now, they get into the temptations of greenwash. In this guide, you're going to learn a lot about greenwash, what it is, why companies do it, and how to avoid it. But the first question must be, why is there greenwash in the first place? Actually, there's a very simple answer to this question. It's that you, the consumer, have started to change your buying patterns in a way that has caught the advertiser's eye. Consider the example of organic for a moment. The Cooperative Bank discovered that organic food sales in the UK have doubled since the year 2000 and are now growing at an average of 25% per year. By 2010, the organic market will be worth at least £2 billion. Think back only a decade or so and imagine trying to buy organic in a high street supermarket. Organic then was for real green enthusiasts, the good life types. Today, organics is huge, a relatively young market spilling out from food to new marketing categories such as beauty products. And new markets make marketers twitchy with excitement. The new green pound. Overall, so-called ethical spending in the UK has jumped by 81% since 2002. Most of us have in the last year bought free-range eggs or products with recycled content like a loo roll or drunk fair trade coffee. At a conservative estimate of £29.7 billion, the market is still relatively minor, but big companies can see the writing on the wall. Green has gone from the smallest of niches to a very desirable market, all set to grow. There's money to be made, and that's the greatest temptation of all. Of course, it's not only purchasing habits that are shifting, but so are public expectations of companies' behavior. An overwhelming majority of us say companies should improve the social and environmental impacts of their products and services, and 83% of us claim to think about a company's green reputation when we shop. A hardcore 38% feel this is very important. I'd fall into that. I'd fall into that for sure. So alongside the big, juicy, organic carrot and the green pound, of the green pound, is the threatening stick of consumers' growing expectations of action. These temptations have led to a boomtown attitude towards green and ethical advertising. Show me the money. According to reports, nearly £17 million was spent on advertising containing the words CO2, carbon, environmental, emissions, or recycle from September 2006 to August 2007 alone. A similar search for the same terms in 2003 uncovers only £448,000 of advertising. That's huge. From less than £500,000 to £17 million. And the new spend wasn't coming from traditional green companies. The deepest pockets are said to be Veolia Environment, ExxonMobil, the UK government, BSkyB, and Marks & Spencer. The numbers aren't in for this year yet, but we can expect to see that spend has doubled or more. Advertising is expensive, and it's not an exact science. As Lord Lever, the foundation of Unilever, purportedly acknowledged, half our advertising is wasted. I just don't know which half. The growth in selling green is a sign of things to come, and you want to buy green. You expect companies to be green, and they have eagerly started to tell you that they are, occasionally without good reason for doing so. Enter greenwash. They get into a bit more of the history, and they get into green words. The term greenwash only officially became part of the English language in 1999, with that entry into the Oxford English Dictionary. But it's been around a lot longer than that. In fact, the first recorded use of the term was by David Bellamy in the periodical Sanity over 20 years ago. By Earth Day in 1990, the concept was catching on. Most greenwash back then didn't include specific claims or marketing messages. Instead, it was more ham-fisted images of frolicking dolphins and lush rainforests set beside the company logo, all to convey an impression of eco-friendliness. These early attempts to green a company's image now seem laughable, especially when you think that Bhopal, Exxon Valdez, and other environmental and social corporate disasters were still fresh in the memory. But even these early attempts at greening company images didn't stay fashionable, and the 1990s saw only occasional greenwash spikes. These were the years of specialist green products and outlets like The Body Shop. Although greenwash may still have been around, the audience affected by it was small and the spending on communications low. Only with the recent green wave, when green consumption first dissolved its boundaries and entered the mainstream, has greenwash raised its head again. And they have some cartoonish examples of things like this, you know. And you've seen this. How many car companies do this? They have a picture of a car, you know, maybe even an SUV, out in the wilderness, and they have things like high performance, low emissions. The petrol scientist says so. I mean, we see this crap all the time. You know, one of the phone companies down here who has a horrendous track record of just, you know, running deep sea cable through, you know, protected areas, not giving a damn. Their ad campaigns for years have been CGI wildlife. You know, just so you wouldn't even think about looking at any of those claims that, you know, they've done huge damage to ecosystems by the way that they go and lay their cable. You know, you'll just have to, you know, disregard that. but it's the utilities sector and the energy sector that actually deal with, you know, get into this greenwashing the most, you know, ads showing, you know, flower petals and stuff coming out of coal power smokestacks. Another one of their cartoonish little mock-ups that they've got here saying, trees aren't the only plants that are good for the atmosphere. Nuclear energy means cleaner air, right? You've heard this crap before. This is all greenwash. And they have some graphage here as well. And talking about, you know, since... The concern for greenwash has boomed. Press coverage and blog searches all show how much buzz around greenwash is currently out there. And it's kind of like since about 2005, 2006, the amount of information on the web just via keywords of greenwash, via blogs and other news sources, has just gone through the roof. Like... 700 times the amount of search keywords found in just a couple of years. So they talk about the greenwash booms. This huge rise in the interest about greenwash has one very tangible measure. The Advertising Standards Authority created a clause for environmental claims in 1995, and since 1998, the UK government has published a non-binding green claims code. Advertising advising advertisers on how best to make good claims. Why is this stuff voluntary? Why are these truth and advertising things voluntary? Shouldn't they be mandatory? If you're going to make claims about your products, shouldn't you have to be able to back them up? Now, I know in the United States we've had issues over truth in advertising come up and have it be decided that we didn't have to have truth in advertising because somehow that broke freedom of speech, which I've never quite been able to get my head around. Kind of just does my head in completely. But before we run out of time, I just want to scroll down here because they talk about the worst sinners. It is perhaps no surprise to find in the charts that they have here that utilities, energy and water companies, etc., have stayed favorites for upheld complaints to the ASA. But since 2006, the numbers for car companies and holiday firms have climbed. The non-commercial sector includes the UK government, although it receives an awful lot more complaints from climate change deniers than are upheld, and also pressure groups whose adverts and leaflets are subject to the same rules as companies. And so for all the complaints that have gone to this UK board over greenwashing, 33.3% comes from motoring companies. 28.6 from the utilities. So, I mean, half of it's coming from where we think it would come from. Coal companies, oil companies, car companies. And one of the things that they talk about as well in this study is a whole lot of the complaints against companies come from their competitors. So as companies are vying for who's the greener or who can put the greener face on, the self-regulating seems to be coming from another direction than the one that you'd think that, you know, I regulate myself. No, here, you're my competitor. You're making a claim that you can't back up, so I'm going to report you. Now, don't look at my claims, because they might just be as bad, but if I can get you done, I'll look greener than you. I was in punk before you were. But we're waking up to it. People are starting to figure it out. Attempts to regulate the increasing flow of greenwash around the world actually predate the most recent flood of complaints by some years. Across the world, different guidelines and rules are enforced to stem the tide. Most are up for review as you read this. As far back as 1992, the United States Environmental Protection Agency and Federal Trade Commission jointly published a set of guidelines for environmental marketing claims. They weren't easy to enforce and were somewhat vague, but they did signal that green issues couldn't be a free-for-all for advertisers. Although they set the early rules, they missed classic greenwash errors, such as the use of environmental visuals and pictures, images of verdant natural scenery with the product center stage, that may make you think green without it ever being said, or making claims that, while literally true, are unlikely to happen in practice. Example, the biodegradable bin bag that is only truly biodegradable when separated from the rubbish it contains. In 2003, the UK government revamped their own green claims code. This code did address previous emissions like those listed above and make specific references to the then new international standard on environmental claims. For the first time, enlightened consumers had a benchmark against which to test green marketers' claims and criteria on which to base complaints. Under the auspices of the Committee on Advertising Practice Code, the UK Advertising Standards Authority can only investigate a potentially spurious claim based on issues around substantiation, generally not the Green Claims Code specifically. Once a complaint has been received, No complaint, no investigation. So the onus is still on the public or commercial rivals to make some noise about dubious marketing practices. This is where I really would like to see some non-private standards. In other words, come up with a code of conduct that if you are going, you know, if you're wanting to get all the benefits and maybe some of the subsidies that are being offered to folks, to companies that will green up their act, maybe you need to prove your green credentials before you can get that money. Kind of makes sense to me. Now, I'm not talking about new power, green power infrastructure, but I mean, I'm talking about just regular old manufacturers of stuff, because these are the outfits that will pull this crap the most. You know, paper products. You know, we get this one organic coffee, and it's imported from Colombia, and it has internationally recognized logos for sustainable farming, and it follows, and it's got labels for the American Organics Foundation and a few of the internationals. It doesn't have the Australian one on it, but I think that's because the labels are all printed for the Americas, and we just get that labeling. But you know, to keep, you know, if your toilet paper is made out of completely 100% recycled paper, you're kind of substantiating your claim, right? Now, the virgin toilet paper with the fluffy looking little tree logo on it saying it's sustainable, that doesn't back up its claim. And this happens all the time. This happens all the time. And the idea, the idea that people still take virgin, brand new tree pulp to wipe their bums with, I find to be one of the most arrogant concepts in this world. You know, recycled paper, what are you talking about? Right. Oh, you really, really needed to kill a fresh tree to wipe your ass. You're telling me that? And then that says, you know, the best thing to do is read the ingredients instead of just listening to the commercial claims. That's absolutely true. However, when it comes to things like cleaning products, it can be really hard to tell, even if the ingredients are listed. I mean, you have to do a lot of research to get your head around, you know, unless you've made the stuff out of bicarbonate soda and whatnot yourself, you just kind of don't know. But I mean, I only got I didn't even get 20 pages into this 44 page report. I definitely suggest it as really great reading. In fact, maybe we should be forwarding this on to this little document on to our representatives, saying, hey, this is pretty good coming out of the UK. Could save you a little bit of work. but anyway, we're gonna wrap it up there. Check it out. There's a link to the PDF on today's show post. Check it out. It's a really, really good read, and there's just heaps to it. But anyway, thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing today. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Ladder Productions for the music. Thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society.